Well, hello everybody. For those of you I haven't met before, my name's Kath. I'm on the staff team here. I must apologise because I responded to one of the prophetic words. I've had a cry. I'm trying my best to keep the lid on now, but that's never happened to me before I speak. So I'm going to do my best to keep it together. If it all goes horribly wrong, we'll hand over to Pete. If you're just joining us for the first time this week, we're right in the middle of a teaching series at the moment, which we started a few weeks ago. It's a series which we've called Name Above All Names, Yahweh Is dot dot dot. And each week we've basically been filling in that blank, that dot dot dot, and looking at one of the eight different compound names that there are for God dotted throughout the Old Testament. So over the past few weeks we've looked at a few different ones. We've looked at Yahweh Shema, meaning the Lord is there. Yahweh Shalom, meaning the Lord is peace. Yahweh Rafi, I think that's how you say it, meaning the Lord is healer. Yahweh Jireh, my provider, meaning the Lord will provide. And each week has been absolutely amazing, focusing on these characters, these different aspects of God, that he's the one who's always with us, no matter what we're going through, that he gives us peace, even at times of war and chaos, that he's a healer and he's a provider. They've been absolutely amazing to focus on these different aspects of God's character. So you can imagine my excitement then when Pete said, do you want to do one of these names in the series as well? And I was thinking, yeah, great, I'd love to do one of these names in the series. They've all been brilliant so far. You know, what gem have you kept up your sleeve for when I'm speaking? We've had healer, peace, provider, they all sound good. And then Pete told me which one he wanted me to speak on, and one word came to my mind, and that was shafted. Absolutely shafted. Because the name we're unpacking this week is Yahweh Nissi. For those of you that have the privilege of growing up in the church during the late 80s and early 90s, you might be familiar with it because it did the rounds in one of those bar mitzvah style songs that were quite popular for a period in church history. If you've no idea what I'm talking about, you're better off that way, I promise you. Don't feel left out. But the name Yahweh Nissi means the Lord is my banner. Sarah Klassen is going to be speaking on this. Yeah, I know, laughter. That's how I felt. Sarah Klassen is going to be speaking on this later on at the 6:30 service. You should stick around because I think it's going to be great. So we met up to share thoughts and stories, and she said her response was exactly the same. She was like, the Lord is my banner? What the heck is that? And I was like, well, at least banner sounds cool in your accent. It doesn't sound so good in mine. But if you're anything like the two of us and not perhaps kind of steeped in extensive Old Testament knowledge, then perhaps your reaction is the same. You hear the word banner, and the things that come to mind are things like those slightly tacky tinfoil sort of banners your mum whips out on your birthday, or maybe you think of a football match. I've never really been to a football match, so I don't know whether they wave banners. That might not be the thing, but I kind of thought that might be a thing. Who knows? Maybe you think of the X Factor or The Voice, where people, slightly creepy fans, draw their own sort of handwritten signs declaring their love and waving them in the crowd. There's all sorts of images that come to mind about a banner. Maybe, again, if you grew up in the 80s or 90s in church, think of those felt banners with the doves. If you weren't there, it's probably better that you weren't. The point is, to refer to the Lord as banner seems pretty alien to us, perhaps more so than some of these other names that we've been looking at. So to understand what the meaning of the name is and still carries today, we need to do a couple of things, which is going to be a pattern familiar to lots of us if you've been around KXC for a while. So firstly, we need to look at what did a banner actually mean in the Old Testament, as the chances are it probably didn't conjure quite the same images as it does now. And secondly, we need to look at when this name was first introduced in the Old Testament. Look at what was going on specifically at that time that resulted in God being known as Yahweh Nissi, the Lord my banner. And to do that, we're going to look at a passage in Exodus 17. So you can turn to there if you want to and have your Bible open. But before we look at that passage specifically, let's just tackle that first question. What was the significance of a banner in Old Testament times? So in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for banner was the word nes, N-E-S, which literally meant a pole or a flagstaff, and was used to refer to the king's standard that an army would carry into battle with them. And this banner had two purposes. Firstly, it acted as a symbol of whose side that you were on. Not dissimilar, if you like, to a way that we would use flags today. So you see this in the way we use flags today. Yes, at times of war, perhaps more sort of peaceably in sporting events. London Olympic opening ceremony, classic example of this. I'm probably one of the only people that still thinks that was one of the weirdest things in the whole world. I didn't like it at all. But for those of you that did tune in and managed to stay to that bit of the proceedings, apparently they all sort of paraded in the A's, the B's, the C's, the D's, the E's, all the nations in alphabetical order, waving their flags proudly, showing which side that they were on. I don't know how many of you feel that patriotic. I don't feel that patriotic that often. But there are moments, whilst they are few and far between, when something happens in the nation that draws out the patriot in me. They're very rare. It never happens, or very rarely happens, during a sporting event. So no offence, but I'm not going to get excited around the World Cup. I apologise for that right now. But there was a moment a couple of years ago when it definitely happened. And the ladies in the room, and maybe some of the men, might know what I'm thinking about. And that was Kate and Will's wedding. It was an amazing time when the patriot in me came to the fore. I don't know what happened to you, but I was honestly genuinely excited. So much so, I didn't actually sleep the night before the wedding. I don't know what happened. I just got very swept into the emotion of the whole thing. So I didn't sleep. And then I got up at 5 a.m. the morning of the big day. I dressed up in an old bridesmaid's dress because I thought it's fitting. I'm just going to get in the mood. I'm going to join in with the sort of bridal party theme. I made my way down to Hyde Park and I got my hand as soon as possible on a flag, a Union Jack that I could wave proudly throughout the day as a sign of my allegiance to the royal family. It lasted about 24 hours. I've not waved a flag before or since. And I'm hesitant to compare a king's standard as they go into battle to a plastic Union Jack on the royal wedding day. But you get the point. The banner is a symbol of allegiance, of whose side you're on. And for an army, it was a symbol of their sense of identity, their strength, and their security was bound up in it as well. So you'll find examples of this scattered throughout the Old Testament. You might want to follow as we go, but don't worry if you don't want to. So Psalm 20 says this: "May we shout for joy over your victory and lift up our banner in the name of our God." Psalm 60 says this: "For those who fear you, you have raised a banner to be unfurled against the bow." Jeremiah 51 says this: "Lift up a banner against the walls of Babylon. Reinforce the guard, station the watchmen, prepare an ambush." So purpose number one of a banner in battle acts as a symbol of allegiance, of strength and security. Purpose number two then of a banner in battle was that it served as a rallying point. Again, this is pretty alien to us. Because when we think of battles nowadays, we think of tanks, we think of guns, there's all sorts of radio communication that goes on. People are very much in touch the whole time when they're fighting. But this is completely different in Old Testament times. In Old Testament times, the way that battles were fought were by hand-to-hand combat, one enemy at a time. So you could find that you were in this one-to-one combat and you completely lost the rest of your army. You were fighting them, this is my sword, my best sword action I can manage. You're fighting them and suddenly you've defeated this enemy and you look around and the army's completely deserted you and they've gone completely elsewhere. And at that moment, you're left really vulnerable and you're left open to attack. So the banner served as this rallying point that you could see, okay, the army's over there, and you'd leg it back over to the banner, you'd leg it back over to where the rest of the army still were and still were fighting, and then you'd be safe because you'd be surrounded by all your comrades. And in that moment as well, you'd also receive your next orders for the instruction in the battle. So a banner served as this rallying point, and again, you'll find examples of this in the Old Testament. Isaiah 11 says this: "In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him. He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth." This idea that Isaiah is talking about, that the banner is the rallying point, the place where people are gathered again from all the places that they've been scattered, to this place of refuge where they can receive renewed directions again. So when you begin to piece some of this together, it begins to sort of make sense why we might refer to God as Yahweh Nissi. The Lord is my banner. Because to say the Lord is my banner is to say the Lord is the one that I've sworn my allegiance to. He's the one whose side I'm on. It's his cause that I'm fighting for. And to say the Lord is my banner is also to say the Lord is the one I run to. He's the one I take refuge in. He's the one I get my marching orders from. Which I guess kind of raises two obvious initial questions for us. And I don't want to spend long on these because I want to move on to Exodus in a second. But two obvious initial questions then. Firstly, whose cause are you fighting for? If someone was to look at your life from the outside, would it be really obvious at the moment whose cause are you fighting for? Because if you're anything like me, yes, we sort of say we want to fight for God's causes, we want to fight for the cause of the kingdom, but we so easily get drawn in to fighting instead for our own causes, where we're at the centre, where we're the kings of our own kingdom. And second question, really obvious question, who or what are you running to when things get tough? All of us have really default positions with this, default reactions when things get tough, places that we flee to seek comfort, to seek security, to seek rescue. But the truth is Yahweh Nissi, the Lord is my banner, and he's the only place of true safety, security and rescue when things start to fall apart around us. And this is something that Moses had really begun to grasp hold of, and it's a situation that involves him actually in Exodus 17, where we come across the name for the first time, Yahweh Nissi. So why don't we turn there now, and we're going to read from verse 8. Says this. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning, but whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner." He said, "Because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." Now again, when I read that passage of scripture, I was like, I have been absolutely shafted here. This is a pretty intense passage of scripture and one that raises all sorts of theological questions. Not least, how can a loving God promise that he's going to blot out an entire nation? And Sarah Klassen's promised an in-depth theological explanation of that later on, so if you want to stick around for that, please feel free to do so. I'm kidding. But what is really, really clear is that in this context, the context of God being named Yahweh Nissi, the Lord is my banner, is in this very specific context of a battle. So the Israelites are under attack from a fierce enemy, the Amalekites. And elsewhere we read that the Amalekites were absolutely brutal and they took no prisoners. So you read about what happens here in Deuteronomy 25 and it says this, "Remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt. When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey and attacked all who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God." They were an absolutely vicious enemy and they moved in for the kill when the Israelites were at their most vulnerable. You know, just before this battle takes place, you'll read about how the Israelites have been wandering in the desert, basically grumbling because they've got nothing to eat. And so they grumble because they've got nothing to eat, and then God shows up and provides them all this food miraculously. And then literally right before the battle, they start grumbling again because they've not got enough to drink. And then God shows up miraculously and they have something to drink. God has essentially led them out of Egypt, and he's leading them towards the promised land, but they've not reached the promised land yet. And it's in that place, in the middle of the promise and its fulfillment, that they're at their most vulnerable and the enemy moves in. And I don't know about you, but I totally resonate with that. Because we've all experienced moments in our lives where we feel like God has promised us something, maybe specifically to us, or maybe sort of through scripture, there's a promise in scripture. And we know that that's true on the one hand, but we live between that and the fulfillment of that promise. And it's in that in-between zone, in that no man's land, if you like, that we feel are our most exposed and our most vulnerable to attack. And Pete touched on this brilliantly the other week when we looked at Yahweh as healer, that when you're living in this gap between the promise that one day you will be healed, either on this side of eternity or the other, and the fulfillment of that promise, it really, really hurts and you're incredibly vulnerable. And it's at those moments that most of us, understandably in some ways, start behaving like the Israelites. We start complaining, we start grumbling, we start questioning God, asking him what's going on. We wonder if he's really good, if he's really faithful, if he's really going to come through for us. But that is not what Moses does. Instead, he instructs Joshua to gather some men for the fight, and he says that whilst they fight, he will raise the banner. And the banner that he is going to raise is what is known as now the staff of God. And Sarah pointed this out to me when we met to chat about this passage. that Moses has a history with this staff. And we know a little bit about it too, if you've been here the last few weeks, because we've looked a little bit about it over the past few weeks. And his history with this staff is that over and over and over again, when he has been at the absolute end of himself, when he's been completely overwhelmed by his own inadequacies, his own powerlessness, God has told him to use this simple shepherd's staff in his hand, and he's seen God perform miracle after miracle after miracle. He's seen his staff turn into a snake. He's seen his staff turn the River Nile into blood. He's seen his staff part the Red Seas. He's literally, just before this battle's taken place, he's used the staff to bring water out of a rock out of nowhere. Moses has this history of God showing up for him in moments of crisis and weakness and using his simple shepherd's staff to perform wonders. So faced with this battle now, he raises the staff in the air above the battlefield. I don't know about you, but I've heard this passage preached on quite a few times, and often when people preach on it, they talk about it in the context of prayer. So this idea that when Moses is raising the staff in his hands on a battlefield, it's a symbol essentially of him praying for the battle that's going on in front of them. And the logic follows that when he's got his arms raised and he's praying for the battle, they're winning. And when he lowers his arms, he stops praying and they start losing. And then he has these two friends either side of him, and when his hands streak, they lift his hands up for him so that they can keep him praying when he's kind of run out of steam to do so. And the sermon normally lands with a question like, how persistent is your prayer life? And who are the people around you that are holding your arms up in those moments it's tough? And I'm not knocking that, because I think that's definitely true, and you can definitely draw that out of this passage. But I actually wonder whether Moses was getting at something quite different in raising his staff above the battlefield. Because what Moses had grasped through his own wrestles with God and his own recent history meant that it absolutely didn't trouble him now that the Amalekites outnumbered them in strength or in skill. It didn't matter if their army was smaller, less well-trained, because he remembered how God had showed up for them in the past when the odds were stacked against them way higher than now. So he raises his staff as their army's banner, not perhaps so much in this posture of prayer, but as their army's flag, as their army's rallying point, and most of all, as this reminder to those fighting, as this way of saying, just look at the staff, everyone. Remember the staff. You know who I am. I'm a murderer. I was then a shepherd. I'm a nobody. I have a stutter. I couldn't lead a nation if I tried, but remember the staff. Remember what God did with my staff. And I wonder too, and this might just be me, that Aaron and Hur being there needed to prop up Moses' arms on either side as a way of saying, it's nothing to do with me. It's not about me. I'm nobody special. I'm weak. I tire out like anybody else. I need people to prop up my arms like anybody else. This isn't about me. It's about the Lord. And so they win the battle, and the text says this. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. But then follows immediately God saying to Moses, I want you to write down what has just happened as something to be remembered. And you need to make sure Joshua hears about this too. Joshua hears about what? He's just overcome with a sword. He knows what's happened on the battlefield. Why does Joshua need to hear this? Moses writes it down. He builds this altar. And it's at that point that when he builds the altar, he calls it Yahweh Nissi, the Lord's my banner. So why does Joshua need to hear this? Because he overcame the army by the sword, but that's not really why he won the battle. And Moses has learned this lesson in his own life, that he is weak, that he's inadequate, but that Yahweh Nissi, the Lord, is his banner, the one who is strong in his weaknesses. But Joshua's going to need to learn this too, because it's him and not Moses that's going to lead the people to the promised land. It's him and not Moses that's going to have to fight many more battles to come to lead the people to the promised land. So Moses writes it down. He makes sure that Joshua knows who the fight really belongs to. And later on, if you read throughout the rest of the Old Testament, you read that Joshua conquers Jericho, one of the kind of biggest battles, and not by might, not by a show of military strength, but by offering his fear, his weakness to the Lord, and then doing what he's told, marching around the city walls with trumpets until the city walls fall down. And it was my sense as I was writing this down that we could insert our own names in place of Joshua's here. That maybe for us today it's as though God's saying, you know, make sure Kath hears this. Make sure Rachel hears this. Make sure Tim hears this. because they haven't grasped this one yet. But if they're going to do all the things in their lives that I've called them to do, they're really going to need to get this. Because if you're anything like me, maybe you're not, but if you're anything like me, maybe you're still plagued and held back by your own inadequacies, your own weaknesses, your own failures. You just can't quite shake them off, no matter how hard you try. And what you try and do is you try and self-improve. You think, oh, I just need to hone this skill a bit more. I just need to get a little bit better at this. Or if you're like me, maybe it's more sort of internal stuff. You think, oh, I just need to grow in confidence. I just need to become a bit more secure in who I am. And we try and we try and we try to make ourselves better, to make ourselves stronger, to make ourselves more resilient. But Moses got it. He'd had it all out on the table with God. He'd laid out all his inadequacies, the very worst of who he was, on the table before God. And God had in turn revealed who he was and turned Moses' weakness into strength. The Apostle Paul really got this too. So much so that he even boasted about his weaknesses. He writes this in one of his letters to the church in Corinth. I was given a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Paul had this weakness, this thorn in the flesh, and theologians have speculated about what the thorn in the flesh was, and we don't know exactly what it was. And at first, he did exactly what most of us do. He pleaded with God to take it away from him. He pleaded with God three times, just take it away from me, take it away from me, until eventually he heard God's voice say, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. This makes absolutely no sense to us in the world that we live in. When we come across a weakness in ourselves, if you're anything like me, our reaction is to either self-improve, to try and make ourselves better, or perhaps, if we have faith in Jesus, to be like, please God, take it away from me. Please God, take this weakness away from me. But Paul, Joshua, and Moses before him learnt the way of freedom, which is to say, I see my weaknesses. I am fully aware of all my weaknesses, and I'm not afraid of them anymore. Because in any place I am weak, there is an opportunity for God to be strong. I was thinking about how this plays out in my own life, and I was thinking about the sort of past year, and probably actually past 2 years for me actually, has been one where I've really, really battled with fear and anxiety and insecurity. And I've battled with some of these things throughout my whole life. I think they were sort of quite pronounced in my sort of teenage years. And then I hit a moment in my early 20s where I felt like God was meeting with me very regularly, and I was feeling healed and freed and released from a lot of that fear and insecurity and anxiety that I'd carried. And I felt like, brilliant, job done, free from fear, got that one absolutely nailed. And then probably 1 or 2 years ago, it suddenly started creeping back in again. I found myself feeling quite fearful, quite anxious, struggling with things like shame a lot of the time. And this sort of been going on for a couple of years. And there were things that were sort of said at the time. There were words that were given to the church at the time. Some of you remember them. We've mentioned them before about maybe a wave of anxiety was going to hit KXC, and that would kind of precede an outpouring of God's Spirit. And I kind of resonated with that at the time. I thought, well, maybe that's what I'm going through. Maybe it's just kind of I'm being allowed to feel anxious because something good's going to come after it. Other times I thought, I don't really think that's what's going on for me. I think this is about my own fears, my own inadequacies, my own sort of brokenness and dysfunction coming out again. And so I tried to sort of wrestle through with some of that. Other times I thought, God, have I done something wrong? Is this some sort of testing from you? Are you just sort of trying to show me something that I've done wrong? The mystics talk about people like St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila. They talk about the dark night of the soul for people in faith sometimes. These experiences where God just seems really, really distant. I thought, well, maybe that's what I'm going through at the moment. But it just dragged on and on and on and on. I couldn't shake it whatever I tried. And my constant prayers were like this. Lord, why is this happening? What's going on? Have I been disobedient? Have I done something wrong at the moment? And to be honest, more often than that, my prayers went something like this: Lord, I feel really afraid. Please help. Lord, I'm so anxious at the moment. Please take my anxiety away from me. Lord, I feel so low at the moment. Please make me feel better. And I'd pray those prayers almost daily, except for the days that I just didn't even want to pray. And I'm aware I'm painting a fairly bleak, quite heavy picture. There were moments of breakthrough, moments where I felt really liberated from fear, moments where I really felt sort of full of God's love and free from that fear. But the general backdrop kind of remained the same, the sense of just really battling with anxiety and fear. And a couple of months ago, this fear like really intensified for me. And there was this one morning I felt really panicky. I thought I was maybe going to have some sort of panic attack. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to pray. So I sat down and started praying. And I did all the same things that I'd done again and again and again. Started going through the same routine of prayers, saying, Lord, please take this fear away from me. Please take this fear away from me. Please take this fear away from me. And I was praying the same prayer that I prayed for these months and months and months. But in that moment, I don't know why then and not another time, I had this image come into my mind. And it was an image of a foot. It was my foot, with a thorn stuck in the bottom of my foot. And as I saw that, I was reminded of these words from the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard. And I hadn't read them myself. I'd heard someone else talk about them. I haven't read any of that stuff. But this phrase from Kierkegaard came into my mind where he said this: with this thorn in my foot, I can spring higher than any man with two sound feet. And that phrase came into my mind, and I had this picture of the thorn. And the next thing that came into my mind was that verse I've just read from Corinthians, where Paul had this thorn in his flesh, and he begged God again and again and again, Lord, please take this away from me. Please take this away from me. But God didn't. Instead, he said, Paul, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And I'm not saying it's wrong to ask God to deliver us from fear or anything like that. We did that earlier, and I think that's an absolutely right prayer to pray. But in that moment, I felt God say to me, you know, you've been asking me again and again and again and again and again to take your fear away. But I just want you to know that out of this fear, this place where you feel utterly weak, where you feel at your absolute worst, you're going to learn what it really means to lean on me. And it's from that place of utter weakness and that place of pain that you're going to find your greatest strength. And the fear didn't lift straight away, but what did happen was the fear of fear lifted. The fear of weakness lifted. And I no longer felt the pressure to get myself together, to self-improve, to make myself stronger. You know, the irony is the more I've given myself permission to feel afraid, to be weak, and in my weaknesses to turn to God and say, Lord, I feel weak again. I feel dreadful again. The more I felt permission to do that, the less afraid, the more peaceful I felt. Because I'm slowly, very, very slowly learning that the success of my life, my usefulness to God in the cause of his kingdom, my value to him absolutely does not rely on my skill. It does not rely on my strength. It does not rely on me having it all together and gradually improving myself and becoming a better and better person. It depends on my willingness to say, Lord, here I am. Here is the very worst of me. Here are my weakest parts. I'm willing. Come and do what you want to do in me. A few weeks ago, a few of us went to the HDB Leadership Conference. I don't know, some of you might have been there as well. And my favourite moment of the whole conference was when Nikki Gumbel, who leads HDB, this church, was interviewing this Benedictine monk, a guy called Brother Luigi, who is my new hero. And if I wasn't getting married, I'd be very tempted to become a nun off the back of hearing him speak. But my favourite part of the interview was Nikki Gumbel was basically asking him about his prayer life. And this guy's a monk. He's kind of lived in or taken orders and has this rhythm of prayer and stuff throughout his life. He's done it for the last 20 years. And he just radiated the love of God. And Nikki Gumbel was asking him about his prayer life. And he was sort of saying, you know, just tell us a little bit about your prayer life. How do you approach prayer when you come to pray in your day? You know, a lot of people come and they come sort of, they need to get themselves in order and they settle down and then they sort of settle down to pray. And he said, you know, what do you think about that? And this monk, this guy, Brother Luigi, just responded by saying, well, that's just utter nonsense. I start every time of prayer with a time of complaining. And he basically went on to say how all his prayer times start by saying, Lord, I feel like this is a total waste of time. I don't really want to be here. I feel like you're not going to come through for me. I'm struggling with this at the moment. I feel anxious about this. I feel angry about this. I feel jealous about this. And he just offers whatever's in his heart to the Lord. And when I heard that, I was so relieved, because when you hear people talk about prayer, holy people, and you say, how do you start your time of prayer? They say, I normally start with the time of thanksgiving. And then I move into working through the Lord's Prayer verse by verse. And they say all these things, and I'm not knocking them, they're amazing things, but how refreshing to hear this guy say, I start with a time of complaining. I start with a time of honesty before God. And he talks about how he doesn't just use that in his quiet time and the one time he comes to pray in his day, but it's become a habit for him throughout the day now. Any time he experiences any sort of emotion, just to offer it to God. So if he feels joy, he'll offer it to God. But also if he feels anger, he'll tell God, Lord, I feel angry. If he's struggling with lust, he'll say, Lord, I'm struggling with lust. If he feels like he hates someone, he'll be like, Lord, I really feel like I hate that person. And nothing's off limits. He just offers whatever's in his heart towards God. And he's just talked about how the more and more he's done that, the more and more he's begun to be able to accept God's love for him in those places as well. This is how he put it. God's presence is about feeling loved and feeling his tenderness. Everything quietens down, and what remains is a feeling of being with him as I am, with my poverty and with my brokenness and with my difficulties, but being loved by him. Now, I absolutely loved it when he said that, because whilst I've really believed for some time that it's really important that we bring the whole spectrum of what we feel and who we are towards God, I think if I'm really honest, I felt like a failure when I can't then move past those feelings. So when I come to God with anger, but I can't leave God's presence feeling peaceful or whatever, I feel like a failure in those moments. But in the days sort of following that interview and following that moment where I felt like God speak to me about the thorn in the foot thing, it slowly began to dawn on me that maybe the goal is not to eliminate weakness, but instead to know what it is to become to be loved in the middle of our weakness. So I've been trying to make that a discipline in my life too. Whenever I feel something throughout the day, just offering it to God. That might be good stuff, it might be stuff that feels hard as well. And as I said, this is something I've done in the past, but the difference is now I name the difficult feelings and I don't just straight away ask God to take them away. I ask him to love me in the middle of feeling them. You know, even a couple of weeks ago, I was due to speak at this church, a friend's church that I'd never been to before, and I was really nervous about it because I'd heard that the congregation were about three times my age, and I was thinking, oh, what are they going to think? And I'd woken up that morning and I felt really nervous about the whole thing. And what made it even worse was I woke up feeling really low. I woke up feeling quite depressed that morning, and I was thinking, oh gosh, I feel low. Okay, what I need to do is sit down, spend some time with God, and work through these feelings of feeling low so that then I can feel strong to deliver this talk later on. So I sat down and I started sort of saying to God, Lord, I just feel really low. I feel unhappy today. Will you just lift these feelings of sadness from me? And I just felt God say to me again, you're doing it again. You're doing it again. I don't need you to get your house in order for me. I don't need you to sort yourself out in order to be useful to me, in order to be acceptable to me. I love you in your weakness as well as in your strength. You know, this is what Moses had learned, and it's in turn what God wanted Joshua to learn too. And it's this kind of freedom that's available to us as well, because Yahweh Nissi, the Lord, is my banner. He is the one whose cause I want to live for, yes. He is the one I want to run to when things get tough, yes. But he is also the one who has the ultimate victory. And the battles that we face and their outcomes are ultimately in his hands. And more than anything, he is the one that when we're weak, then he is strong. I want to finish there, so why don't we just stand and we'll respond.